House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:38 p.m. It's Friday, March 5th. I want to make a brief note. We started a little bit late for those that are online. We started a little bit late because there was fresh bread back in my office, and members of the committee felt that fresh bread took some priority because it's still warm. And so I can only apologize that you weren't able to enjoy it. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, make sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Alex from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today here in the room, we have Representative Eastman, Representative Vance, I believe Representative Christ Tompkins is online, Representative Drummond, Representative Kirka, my vice chair, Representative Snyder, is online, and myself, Chair Klayman. And we have a quorum to conduct business. As a matter of housekeeping, the goal for this committee for COVID-19 precautions will be to have a maximum of 15 people in this room, including committee members, LAO staff, the Judiciary Committee aide, individuals testifying or presenting, and legislative staff. I will ask staff to generally self-regulate. If needed, I can give more specific directions as needed, but as long as people are kind of cognizant that we're trying to work on 15 people in the room, and if you want to have your staff in from time to time, as long as we're all kind of working on the 15 number, that should work. And I'd also note that if maintenance is on schedule by Monday, we should have an extended U, and so instead of the littler tables, we'll have microphones, and the whole structure will be about 6 feet longer and look very similar. So that's some of the efforts we're doing here in terms of COVID-19 precautions. Our first and only order of business today is House Bill 105, Detention of Minors, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the governor. This is the first hearing of the bill in the Judiciary Committee. Online to present the bill is Tracy Dompling, Director, Division of Juvenile Justice, and Matt Davidson, Social Services Program Director, Division of Juvenile Justice. If the two of you could please identify yourself for the record, and you may begin your remarks.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Klayman and House Judiciary Committee members. Are you guys hearing an echo?
We don't hear an echo.
Okay, it's just on my end. I will power through. Thank you. For the record, my name is Tracy Dompling, and I'm the Director of the Division of Juvenile Justice in the Department of Health and Social Services. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present on House Bill 105 today. This is a bill which will bring Alaska into compliance with recent changes to the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, also abbreviated as JJDPA, which was initially enacted in 1974 and then reauthorized in 2018. The JJDPA is the primary piece of federal legislation that governs juvenile justice practices throughout the nation. Our lack of compliance with the JJDPA will lead to severe grant penalties on one of the division's major grants. HB 105 makes two changes in statutes to bring us into compliance. First, it will require that minors who have been waived into the adult criminal justice system be held in juvenile justice systems or in the juvenile justice system until they reach age 18. Currently, minors who are subject to automatic waiver or discretionary waiver statutes are held in adult jails and correctional facilities in our state. The bill also expands the court findings that are necessary for non-delinquent minors to be held temporarily in a secure juvenile justice facility. This bill is limited in scope, and it intentionally has no impact on the crimes or sentences of minors who are subject to waiver into the adult criminal justice system, nor will there be any net fiscal impact. If implemented, this bill will improve the conditions of confinement for minors who are held in adult facilities. Currently, they can be fairly difficult to manage in adult facilities and can sometimes be held in segregation units. But in order for us to accomplish this, the bill will require the Department of Corrections and the Department of Health and Social Services to develop agreements about the holding of minors in DOC custody in our DJJ facilities. Data that was provided yesterday by the Department of Corrections identified 6 youth statewide under the age of 18 who are held in one of their DOC facilities. The second change that will be made by the bill deals with the limited circumstances under which non-delinquent minors may be held temporarily in a secure juvenile facility pending another placement. These situations are very rare. These are usually youth who are in the custody of the Office of Children's Services, who are running away from placement and putting themselves in dangerous situations. In those circumstances, the state seeks court findings under 4710.141, allowing these youth to be held securely for a short period of time pending placement in a non-secure setting. So the new federal JJDPA expands those court findings that are necessary where those minors can be held in our detention facilities, and it further limits the duration of the time that they're able to be securely held. As I mentioned, these are rare cases. In the last three fiscal years, we have had three instances each year where non-delinquent youth have been held under this particular statute. So in closing, we appreciate the governor's support on this important legislation, also the cooperation of the Department of Corrections, Public Safety, and Law in the development of the proposal. Since the introduction, we've had good feedback from the court system as well as other stakeholders, which we hope to address during this process. I want to thank you for your time and support today. I'm happy to answer any questions now or after Matt Davidson presents the sectional summary.
We'll go ahead and ask questions start with Ms. Dompling. I would go around the committee, and as usual, I'm going to limit committee members to 1 minute per question. If the time goes beyond 1 minute and you haven't posed a question to the presenter, then I will move on to the next person. But we'll start with Ms. Dompling. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Now, just for the record, I know there's a lot of different things going on in this bill. So if this bill were to pass, what would the status or impact be on a minor who was convicted of a particularly heinous or egregious crime? Obviously, we're seeing in the headlines this week of the mother that was killed by a minor in Colorado earlier this week. So if there's a particularly heinous conviction, would that individual still be eligible for incarceration under Department of Corrections, or would this change the status of what could happen to that individual?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it changes the way in which the youth will be held. They would still be tried as an adult if they fell under the automatic waiver statute. They would be held in the juvenile justice facility until they reached age 18. The bill, which I'm sure Matt will talk about a little more in detail during the sectional analysis, that there are circumstances under which the Department of Health and Social Services, DJJ, could go back and request a hearing before the court if for some reason that minor in our juvenile facility was so out of control and aggressive that beyond something that we could handle, which we do handle a lot, even with minors who don't fall underneath the automatic waiver statutes. So there is a situation or kind of a relief valve, so to speak, where we could go back and there's specific findings which would have to be made by the court then for that juvenile to then be able to be held in a DOC facility, which would not count against us as a penalty for a violation of the JJDPA.
Follow-up?
Representative Eastman.
So do I understand correctly that, even if there was a particularly heinous conviction, say a multiple homicide, that with passage of this bill, that minor would be at least initially held with other minors until some court proceedings demonstrated that that wasn't the right place for him?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that is correct. They would be held with other minors. I do like to remind folks that the automatic waiver statute really looks at youth that are age 16 and 17 that are committing those heinous acts. Unfortunately, we do have youth who fall under that age range that are in our juvenile facilities who commit similar acts as well.
And just for matter of clarification of Representative Eastman, if you had somebody that was 16 years old, committed an assault and was sentenced as an adult to 10 years, the practical impact of this statutory change would be that they would stay in the juvenile detention facility until they turned 18, and when they turned 18, they would then be transferred to a Department of Corrections facility.
Yes, Chair Clayman, that is correct.
Okay. Any other questions from Ms. Doppling before we go to Mr. Davidson? Mr. Davidson, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I believe the committee's been provided a copy of the sectional analysis, and I'll just briefly go through the sectional summary. So section one is the amendment to the Department of Corrections statute, so the commissioner, the duties of the commissioner of the Department of Corrections, and just spells out that the Department of Corrections will enter an agreement with the Department of Health and Social Services related to the holding of minors in DOC custody because, through the waiver process, who will now be held in DJJ custody under the bill. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill relate to the second major change of the proposal, which is in Child Protection Statute 4712.141. And those two sections explain the new court findings and limits on the holding of non-delinquent minors in our facilities. Again, as the director mentioned, it's very rare. Very rarely do we ever hold non-delinquent minors. It's not really our business. But in some cases, the court finds and the Office of Children Services requests that minors be held temporarily. And generally, that's for less than 24 hours. As noted in the bill, in some rare instances, it's longer than 24 hours before a better placement is found. The rest of the next section 4, 5, 6, and 7 really are, I would say, conforming changes, but I will go through them. Section 4 is the jurisdiction section of Juvenile Justice Statute. Basically adding that the division has authority and jurisdiction to hold minors who are actually not delinquent. They are have committed criminal acts under the adult statute. So that is one complication of this is 4712 mostly deals with delinquent minors, and these are non-delinquents. These are adult offenders in the case of the law. The law, you know, defines them as adults for the waivers. Again, Section 5 is applicability of the and jurisdiction for the division to handle these minors in our statute, even though they are not technically delinquents. 4712.030, Section 6 is actually where the auto waiver is held in our statute. And so we are just adding a reference to the holding of these minors. They are waived into the adult process, but they will be held by the juvenile justice system. So that it's kind of hidden in 030, but the 030A is what we technically call the auto waiver statute. And you can see, if you looked at 4712.030, you'll see the list of offenses that qualify minors for auto waiver. Section 7 is what we commonly call the discretionary waiver, and that is for, as Representative Eastman mentioned, heinous crimes that very rarely happens for minors who don't qualify for the auto waiver, but they are not amenable for treatment in the juvenile justice system, and then the department seeks to have them waived, a court finding to have them waived into the adult system. Again, we call that the discretionary waiver. It's at the discretion of the court, not at the department. And those cases are very rare to happen. So those are the two waivers, six and seven. And we just add the conforming amendments there. Section 8, I think, is the meat of the bill for the division, which is describes the new program. And the agreement between DOC and the Department of Health and Social Services to hold minors who are waived into the adult system. Part B and C and D describe the exceptions to the rule, if you will, where we would seek to have a court make a decision that a youth does not belong in a juvenile system. And the cases that are, that the situations when that might happen that we've kind of brainstormed about and we think would be included in the, in this, in these waivers, sorry, exceptions is a better word there, would be when there is a minor who's waived to the adult system and they are from a community with a court, but there's no juvenile facility in that community. And if the, if there's a necessity to have that, those trials held in a community without a juvenile facility, we would like the option, and the federal law gives us the option to have a court finding to say that they could have, be held in a adult facility during that trial period. So we don't have, so the Department of Public Safety doesn't have to transport them back and forth or another difficult situation. So that's the exception, one of the exceptions. The other exception that we think is could happen would be minors who are just inappropriate for a juvenile facility for whatever reason, either too violent or on the verge of their 18th birthday. So when this bill goes into effect, we might, we're likely to have 17-year-olds who are nearly 18. There's really no point in moving them to a juvenile facility for a month or two. And so we might seek a variance from the court for those particular minors when and if this bill goes into effect. Section 9 adds language that just specifies that these minors would be held and treated really the same way that minors are held, other minors are held in DDJ facilities. There are retained parental rights to major medical decisions that exist for our minors in our facilities, and we just want to extend that to minors who are waived into the adult system. This is the same rules that apply to minors who are held in DOC custody, but we just wanted to put them on parallel footing for clarity for our staff in terms of how they're held. So major medical, there's existing parental rights that do happen when minors are held in DOC or DDJ custody. Parents are not, their parental rights are not terminated in that case. Section 10 is a conforming change to what we call the dual sentencing provisions of our statute. That is also rarely used, but it's just a conforming change. Dual sentencing is a situation where a minor commits a crime that and then is tried in both juvenile and adult court. It's a very rare statute. It's not used very often. Section 11 just makes conforming changes to clarify that when a minor is arrested, that they would, for a waivable offense, they would be brought to a juvenile facility. Just makes it eligible there. It's very similar to Section 12 and 13. The temporary detention and temporary detention hearings, it's again, we're just trying to fit this square peg of non-delinquent minors into our existing delinquency statute. So we just want to make reference to the ability to hold minors who are actually adults in the eyes of the court in our juvenile facilities under the same conditions. Section 14 and 15 deal with agency records, and this is what we call our confidentiality statute, and just wanting to make sure that we can share information back and forth between Department of Corrections and the Department of Health and Social Services about these minors as they are going to potentially be moving back and forth between DOC and DJJ facilities in some cases, and we just want to make sure that we are clear about that. Otherwise that we would have difficulty in that. In that information sharing, we would have to have another finding, so we want to be explicit about that information sharing. There's a repealer section that basically speaks to how the transfer of custody happens for auto waivers and applicability cause. And that's all I have here. Obviously, the reviser set the reviser section deals with the executive order about the bifurcation of the Department of Health and Social Services. There, you know, obviously there would be some changes that would need to be made, including the name of the departments that are coming up into agreement on this process. I'm I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Davidson. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. You spoke a minute ago about a variance, in which case the department may be asking the courts for a variance due to a minor who is too violent. So in that sort of situation, how would that process normally work, and you know what sort of timelines involved during the process of requesting that variance? Would we expect the minor to be held by the department for some period of time? If so, how long?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this would be describing a new process that was allowed under the federal act. And we have been in good conversations with the courts since introduction of this bill to determine what that would look like. They've in fact asked us to look at what that process would be. But my expectation is, in the case of a violent offender, we would be seeking it very quickly. As the directors noted, we do handle violent offenders and are equipped to handle them. But in some cases, we're taking advantage of the federal variance process and want to include that option in the bill. It's hard to say how long it will take. It hasn't been designed yet.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding Section 18, obviously this is revisor's instruction, but it does make me want to know if the executive order to divide the Health and Social Services departments, is that going to have any impact on how your department deals with these juveniles?
Tracy, you want to take that?
Sure. For the record, this is Tracy Dompling, Director of DJJ. If I understand your question correctly, it was if we did end up under the new department, would there be a change to how we handle these youth? Is that correct?
I'm wanting to know, that decision has come before us of whether we are going to agree with the governor's executive order. And I'd like to know the impacts to your department if it is supported or if the executive order fails to pass the legislature.
All right. Thank you, through the chair, Representative Vance. I don't think there's any impacts, whether we're under the Department of Health and Social Services or the new department. We won't see any impacts, per se, on the way we do our DJJ business. I think for us, we've kind of been pretty clear all along with our department that things should go off without a hitch, basically, that there won't be really any impact to our staff or the residents or our families that we serve.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions from members of the... Oh, Representative Eastman, go ahead.
Thank you. Just going back to the earlier question on variance. So if the department requests a variance and the court, for whatever reason, denies that variance, what facilities does the department currently have for that, you know, very violent individual?
I'll go ahead and take that, Matt. Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we have six detention facilities in our state. We do have a secure treatment unit for pretty significantly, severely violent juveniles. We wouldn't normally hold detention-type youth or, in this instance, pre-conviction youth in that facility. Honestly, our staff in all of our facilities are trained on how to, you know, physically manage youth in our care if their behavior is out of control, if it's a danger to themselves, or if it's a danger to staff or other residents. So they would be, they pretty much, unless it was a severe, dire consequence, I mean, we may find ourselves trying to make exceptions and having that youth placed on that secure treatment unit. At this point, we're doing the best that we can to kind of think about all the what-ifs, but we're going to be certainly working on that as a division as we move forward throughout this process.
I would note also, online we have Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections, Kelly Good, is available to answer questions, and Nancy Mead The General Counsel of the Alaska Court System is here in the room with us if anyone has questions either for the Department of Corrections or the court system. Just let me know and we'll get them available. I don't see any other questions from the committee. We do have one person that wants to provide public testimony, so I'm going to open the hearing for public testimony on House Bill 105. And Amy Gorn, I believe you're here to provide public testimony. I'm not sure if you're on the phone or on the Teams thing. Ms. Gorn, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay, if you want to proceed with your testimony, we generally try to limit public testimony to 2 minutes. I know you're on the Alaska Juvenile Advisory Committee, and depending on your comments, I may give you a little more time than 2 minutes, but go ahead and identify yourself, please.
Yeah, thank you. This will be brief. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Amy Gorn, and I'm a resident of Wasilla. I am the chair for the governor-appointed Alaska Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, known as AJAC. In prior years, fellow AJAC members and I have been able to meet in person with representatives and senators as we distributed our annual report. AJAC represents Alaska as its state advisory group through the DOJ Juvenile Justice Delinquency and Prevention Act, which provides funding to the Division of Juvenile Justice. State advisory groups guide the compliance of the Act's four core mandates. And I'm pleased to say DJJ is in compliance with these critical requirements from federal legislation. However, the GGDPA was reauthorized by Congress in 2018 with this new requirement impacting the sight and sound separation of juvenile and adult offenders. It is important to AJAC that Alaska remains in compliance with federal legislation. The proposed agreement and coordination between DJJ and DOC in HB 105 will improve the safety of minor offenders, will prevent the segregation of juveniles and their possible isolation, and positively impact recidivism, as research shows a lower likelihood of minors reoffending when remaining in juvenile custody. So in brief, the Alaska Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee is in support of HB 105, and I ask Judiciary Committee members to pass this bill out of committee and bring it closer to a House vote in respect to the compliance deadline at year's end. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Gorn. I believe Representative Kirka has a question for Ms. Gorn or for one of the other folks.
I'm not sure, actually.
All right, well, fire away.
But I guess anybody can take a crack at answering this. But so it sounds like the main purpose of this bill is to bring us in compliance with Congress's adjusted rules. I guess the question is, what are the consequences if we don't pass this? What are the consequences of not being in compliance?
Ms. Gorn, you actually may be able to respond to that question. And if you can't, then I suspect that Ms. Dompling can respond to that question. Ms. Gorn, I'll give you the first shot, and then I'll actually give Ms. Dompling a follow-up regardless. Go ahead, Ms. Gorn.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'll respond just very briefly, as I know the director will have more information. There could be some financial penalties to funding received from the DOJ. That is, as we understand it, not as determined at this time, but it can jeopardize the funding that we receive through Title II grant funds. So thank you for the question.
Ms. Dompling, do you want to respond to the same question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Kirka. If a state is out of compliance with the core requirement of the JJDPA, they initially off the top take a 20% reduction off of that. It's our Title II grant money. So initially we would lose 20% of that money. The remaining money that then the state receives in the Title II funds, the state has to then devote 50% of those funds to actually coming into compliance with that particular core mandate for which they've received the penalty. So what that means for DJJ is that we use the Title II grant monies for many different activities in juvenile justice. Some of our grantees are individual tribal communities who receive mini-grants through DJJ from the Rural Alaska Community Action Program. Those are usually cultural and leadership-type programs that are available to youth and communities as a way to prevent them from actually becoming involved with the juvenile justice system. We also have some grantees, Covenant House Alaska in Anchorage, Presbyterian Hospitality House in Fairbanks, and then the Youth Advocates of Sitka, all of which provide non-secure alternatives to detention for youth that maybe have committed a delinquent offense but have not met the statutory requirements of danger to self or others in order to be held in one of our facilities. And so that gives an alternative, positive support for kids when they maybe aren't able to go back home at that point in time. We also use Title II funds for our electronic monitoring devices that we have located in various probation offices around the state.
Representative Kirka, does that call for any follow-up?
Not this time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. It does have a follow-up from you, Ms. Dompling. So the Title II funds, in terms of supporting the general juvenile justice function of the department, how much of the department funds are actually federal funds as opposed to state funds? In percentages, if not dollar figures.
Chair Klayman, I would probably prefer just to get the committee that information. I know it should be on the tip of my tongue since I have a budget presentation on Monday morning, but I don't have it right now. So if I could get that back to you, that would be great.
That would be great. I'll just provide a little bit more background. I'm interested because as I'm hearing your testimony as well as Ms. Gorn's testimony, we actually put at risk some of the federal money that provides some foundational support for the work that we do in juvenile justice. And so I'd be interested to see, I'd be interested to actually, since you're going to have time to get the information together, how much are we putting at risk by not passing this statute, both in terms of percentage of budget, but also in terms of real dollars? Because if we're losing if we would cause a 20% penalty of a fairly large amount of money that supports your department's work, I think it would be good for us to know that. Any other questions for either anybody here on the bill? Okay. I'm going to close public testimony. Well, I don't see anyone else in the room that would like to testify, and there's no one else online, so I'm closing public testimony on House Bill 105. And this is my plan with regard to the bill. I would actually like, before we move the bill, I would like to have an opportunity for the public defender to provide their perspective on the bill, since they represent many of the juveniles that might be subject to this. We checked to see if she was available today. She's actually traveling and probably not available before Tuesday. So my plan will be to hear this bill again on Wednesday next week. And I will ask that if you're thinking of any amendments to the bill, please have them to my office electronically by noon on Tuesday. And my plan on the bill would be that we would not only be able to hear from the public defender on Wednesday, we'd be able to take up any amendments and ideally move the bill. But I did want to have an opportunity to get the public defender's perspective before we take final committee action. But I do think it's reasonable to have an amendment deadline for Tuesday. So that's where we are on House Bill 105. We will now adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Monday, March 8th at 1:30 p.m. after we finish whenever we're finished with the budget stuff, but we will adjourn. We'll meet next on Monday at 1:30, and with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is now 2:12 p.m.